Srimad-Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 4. Ambarish Maharaj offended by Durvasa Muni. Yadaragara putrapta banan vitam imam param amam sharanam yata hitam tams chaktumutsahe. Translation. Supreme Personality God is continuing to speak to Durvasa Muni. Since pure devotees give up their homes, wives, children, relatives, riches, and even their lives simply to serve me without any desire for material improvement in this life or in the next, how can I give up such devotees at any time? Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is worshipped by the words, Brahmanya Devaya Go Brahmanya Hitaya Cha. Thus, he's the well-wisher of the Brahmanas. Durvasa Muni was certainly a very great Brahmana, but because he was a non-devotee, he could not sacrifice everything in devotional service. Great mystic yogis are actually self-interested. The proof is that when Durvasa Muni created a demon to kill Maharaj Ambarish, the king stayed fixed in his place, praying to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and depending solely and wholly on him. Whereas, when Durvasa Muni was chased by the Sudatan Chakra, by the supreme will of the Lord, he was so perturbed that he fled all over the world and tried to take shelter in every nook and corner of the universe. At last, in fear of his life, he approached Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and ultimately the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He was so interested in his own body that he wanted to kill the body of a Vaishnava. Therefore, he did not have very good intelligence. And how can an unintelligent person be delivered by the Supreme Personality of Godhead? The Lord certainly tries to give all protection to his devotees, but have given up everything for the sake of serving him. Another point in this verse is that attachment to Dharagara Gutrapta, home, wife, children, friendship, society, and love, is not the way to achieve the favor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One who is attached to hearth and home for material pleasure cannot become a pure devotee. Sometimes a pure devotee may have a habit or attraction for wife, children, and home, but at the same time want to serve the Supreme Lord to the best of his ability. For such a devotee, the Lord makes a special arrangement to take away the objects of his false attachment, and thus free him from attachment to wife, home, children, friends, and so on. This is special mercy bestowed upon the devotee to bring him back home, back to Godhead. Om Jnana Chimarandasya Jnananjana Shalataya Chakshundaritam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Vidava Shri Srivasani Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. You hear this verse. Since pure devotees give up this, give up that, give up such, so on and so forth, you might think that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is justifying the situation of Durvasa Muni, because Durvasa Muni, he had no possessions, he was an extraordinary Brahmana, renounced an ascetic. So it would seem that Durvasa Muni indeed is free of all attachments, whereas Ambarish, who is, from the ordinary point of view, living on the lap of unparalleled luxury, it would seem that Ambarish Maharaj is so attached. Upon hearing this verse, you may think that, well, one should just walk away from everything. That is the point of spiritual life. Arjuna, had this misunderstanding at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. That Krishna, first you talk about renouncing, at the same time, while you're talking about renouncing the results of activities, being detached from material nature, you've given me knowledge of the soul, how it's different from the body, at the same time, tatkin karmani gore mam, how can you urge me to fight in this ghastly war? Of course, by Arjuna's apparent confusion, he's clearing the way for Krishna to present action in Krishna consciousness, bhakti, which is not about the material vision of asceticism. As we all know, or should know, renunciation in bhakti is about letting Krishna be the enjoyer of everything and using whatever one has in one's field of activities. Use that for Krishna's pleasure. So in this way, Ambarish Maharaj excels, just as Arjuna excelled in Bhagavad Gita by agreeing to fight. Bhagavad Gita begins its deep penetration when Arjuna admits his confusion and accepts Krishna as his teacher. You're more than a friend, Krishna. In this situation, I'm asking you to show me your capacity as instructor. Now, friendly talks have ceased. I am your disciple. I am a soul surrendered to you. Please instruct me. In this way, Bhagavad Gita and its dynamics penetrate the heart because of Arjuna's surrender to Krishna, meaning accepting the need for guidance and instruction from Krishna. Krishna is taking the role of the guru, and Arjuna is taking the role of the disciple. And at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna confirms, I have achieved the result of surrender. What does surrender mean? Sometimes, as I explained, we have a negative conception of that word. We think it's like you're walking down a dark street at night and some robber emerges out of the shadows, surrender your purse, surrender your wallet, or else you surrender your life. So we kind of react to Krishna's proposal at the end of Bhagavad Gita. We kind of react in that way. Krishna's trying to stick me up. He's trying to take everything I have. It's going to be a very unpalatable, very traumatic experience, just as if you were mugged on the street. You have everything you have. Empty your pockets. Where's your wallet? Where's your purse? This paranoia is due to our conditioning, specifically our rebelliousness. By reading Bhagavad Gita again and again and trying to apply it, we realize that Arjuna didn't have that kind of paranoia. He blissfully accepted Krishna's instruction and acted on it, and therefore he confirmed to Krishna, Nashta moha smritir labdha. My illusion, it's all gone now. Krishye vachanamtava. I'll act. I'll continue to act on what you say. So that is the proper dynamic of the guru-disciple relationship. The disciple wants encouragement. The disciple wants knowledge. especially knowledge that can help you in your specific situation. How you can avoid the impediments to bhakti, and how you can take advantage of what accelerates bhakti. We often explain that devotional service has an inbuilt need for guidance. Material existence means we want to reject the guidance of Krishna. That's why we are here. So the spiritual master trains the disciple in how to act favorably to Krishna. And this way, as we heard in yesterday's purport, the number of devotees increase unlimitedly. Because Krishna is unlimited, he wants to see unlimited devotees. So the spiritual master is the humble servant of Krishna for training the devotee how to please Krishna. Ambarish Maharaj has untold opulence. Durvasa Muni is an ascetic, a Brahmana sage. You would say Durvasa Muni has nothing. Ambarish Maharaj has everything. Yet you see in this verse that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is glorifying Ambarish Maharaj and all pure devotees by saying they give up their homes, their wives, children, relatives, riches, even their lives. You say, well, how does that apply to Ambarish Maharaj? Doesn't sound like he's given up his wife, who was equally as qualified as him. He's got royal power. He's got a palace, children, relatives. But you see, even though Ambarish Maharaj had all those things, he recognized that 100% Krishna is the proprietor. And he used everything in Krishna's service. Now you might say, well, if I had, you know, all that, yeah, I would use it in Krishna's service too. So therefore, why doesn't Krishna give me all that opulence? And yeah, then we can talk about, you know, engaging in his service. But since I don't have that opulence, therefore, it has to be practical. As they say, live in the real world. Make spiritual life your lesser priority. We're learning to see Ambarish Maharaj's bhakti. How it actually is not dependent on his external situation. His bhakti is not dependent on his opulence. That's why we heard that he considered all his opulence to be like something you see in a dream. It's hard for us to understand how he can have all that and yet consider it to be just like a piece of stone. How can that be? You can just hear your material mind speaking to you. Come on, come on, Ambarish. We know you really like having all that opulence. We know you're having a good time. We appreciate your prayers. We appreciate your devotional words, but you must... Come on, you like having all the opulence, don't you? You like having a palace, a wife who's equally as qualified as you. You like all that. But by this situation of being persecuted by Durvasa Muni, you see completely where Maharaj Ambarish is at. And that's why the Supreme Personality of Godhead is saying in this verse about his pure devotees giving up homes, wives, children, relatives, riches, even their life itself, simply to serve me. You see, And Ambarish Maharaj's response: when the fiery demon created by Durvasa Muni is approaching, he just stands there, praying to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, what would you like of me? Now, does that mean whenever we are in some danger of being attacked by someone, we should not try to protect ourselves? This requires some intelligence. Srila Prabhupada once explained that if a devotee is about to be attacked by someone, you do the necessary to avoid any harm because you're serving Krishna. So why should this person hamper your service to Krishna? That means you do your best to avoid being harmed because you don't want your service unnecessarily hampered by bodily injury. It's all about service, not, I don't want any bodily harm because I got some enjoying plans I have to execute. No, you protect yourself because you're protecting your service to Krishna. That's also why devotees should take care of their health. Not so they can enjoy material life, but so they can be more enthusiastic and energetic in Krishna's service. So these are basics that we always need to be reminded about. Because Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains that this knowledge of yukta vairagya, using everything material in Krishna's service, is actually confidential knowledge. We kind of refer to it as ordinary. You know, use it all in Krishna's service, Prabhu, whatever you have. This is actually topmost mystic yoga. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains that commentary in 11th canto. Yukta vairagya is a confidential principle. It's very high. It's just that our acharyas, especially Srila Prabhupada, have just made that concept so brilliantly clear that we take it for granted now. Yeah, use it all for Krishna's service. In this way, we fail sometimes to see our great fortune, and how, knowingly or unknowingly, we've been given the pinnacle of bhakti. So this verse is actually turning the tables. It appears from the external point of view that Durvasa Muni has given up everything, and that Ambarish Maharaj is just swimming in attachment. But by the Sudarshan chakras chasing Durvasa Muni, you get to see where Durvasa Muni really is at. The chakra is illuminating everything. Big, big mystic yogi, but just to save your own skin, you were willing to kill a devotee, and now you're running all over the universe to save your body. So this is what the Supreme Personality of Godhead is implying to Durvasa Muni. We discussed a bit yesterday about how Durvasa Muni tried to defend himself. Namo Brahmanya Devaya. Go Brahmanya, entire job. You're the protector of the Brahmanas. I'm a Brahmana. And he was a very extraordinary Brahmana. So what was the Supreme Personality of Godhead's reaction? Not good enough. You're not a devotee. Moreover, you tried to kill a devotee. If I protect you, that means I'm giving up my devotee. I can't do that. This is why we see in the word for words. Katam tams chaktum utsahe. How can I be enthusiastic? It's not possible. I can't be enthusiastic to protect you because you've attacked my devotee. Brahmana, that's very nice, but Devotee, that's another category. So therefore, Utsahe. It's not possible for me to be enthusiastic in that way. I can't do it, even though you're a Brahmana. In this way, we see the dependency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that is astonishing to Devasamuni. Brahma expressed his dependency. How can I help you? I'm dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Even Shiva, Devasamuni's worshipful Lord, has expressed his dependence. Sorry, can't help. Now, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself says, I've got my own version of dependence. I'm not independent. I'm dependent on my devotee. So the incident of the Sudarshan Chakra chasing Devasamuni throughout the universe has actually, the chakra has illuminated the principle of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's dependency on devotee. We'll go to the next verse. As chaste women bring their gentle husbands under control by service, the pure devotees, who are equal to everyone and completely attached to me in the core of the heart, bring me under their full control. Purport. In this verse, the word samadarshana is significant. The pure devotee is actually equal toward everyone, as confirmed in Bhagavad Gita. Brahmabhuta prasanatma nashochati nakanchati samasarveshu bhuteshu. Universal brotherhood is possible when one is a pure devotee, pandita samadarshana. A pure devotee is actually learned because he knows his constitutional position. He knows the position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he knows the relationship between the living entity and the Supreme Lord. Thus, he has full spiritual knowledge and is automatically liberated, Brahmabhuta. He can therefore see everyone on the spiritual platform. He can comprehend the happiness and distress of all living entities. He understands that what is happiness to him is also happiness to others, and that what is distress to him is distressing for others. Therefore, he is sympathetic to everyone. As Prahlad Maharaj said, Choche tuto vimukache tasa indriyata maya sukaya bharam utvahato vimudan. People suffer from material distress because they are not attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A pure devotee's chief concern, therefore, is to raise the ignorant mass of people to the sense of Krishna consciousness. Yes, we aspire to make that our chief concern. How to raise the ignorant mass of people to understanding that bhakti is so powerful, it even controls the Supreme Personality of God. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami writes that the most inconceivable thing in all existence is actually how the infinitesimal Supreme Absolute Truth, the infinite Supreme Absolute Truth, the unlimited Supreme Absolute Truth, comes under the control of his tiny devotee. This is the most inconceivable thing in existence. How the infinite comes under the control of the finite. This is the glory of bhakti. Well, how can that happen? You get a hint in this text 66. A very big hint. As we're attempting to do sometimes, you're getting an example from everyday life. And that example is used to give transcendental import. And of course, I don't know how prevalent this example is these days, but as chaste women bring their gentle husbands under control by service. I remember I was once at the loft in Auckland speaking to a whole class of high school girls came in, 15, 16 years old. And so they're asking questions. So I said, well, I'd like to ask you a question. Does anyone here know what the word chase means? And they kind of all looked at me. They sound like a word we heard somewhere, but one asked, is it an English word? So finally, all agree, we don't know what it means. So then I explained what it meant. They all kind of looked at me like, that's no fun. This is the situation today. I've been speaking at a few places before the festival. I explained something that just happened to me, an encounter at the loft in Auckland. Some devotee, I think it might have been Aki Tavali, she brought in some young ladies to talk to me. I thought, 19, 20 years old. So I started talking to them. And I just asked, and by the way, how old are you? 15, 16. But they were already looking like, they were fully into adult activities. So I asked, where are you from? I said, from North Shore, Auckland. So I said, well, what's the latest there? what's going on? How's the party scene? I said, last time I heard, that was 5 years ago. I know it's a long time, 5 years ago. Things have changed rapidly. But 5 years ago, the young ladies told me, you know, when they were 13, 14, 15, they go to parties and they mainly stand around and talk. The girls talk to each other while the guys are trying to get them to drink more. And so then the guys can kind of, you know, like a wolf carrying away a lamb, you know. As soon as they see a girl gets a bit tipsy, they can carry her off, you know, into the bushes. So they, these 15-year-old girls, they said, oh, that was 5 years ago. Things are different now. Now, 13, 14, 15-year-olds go to parties with the firm idea we're going to get totally blasted and wasted, and the guys are going to maul us. They already have that in their mind. Going to a party, we're going to get completely drunk out of our minds, and we know we're going to get mauled, and that's the party. This is how quickly things are degenerating. Therefore, when we hear Srimad Bhagavatam, it's like coming from another world. But we need to know what is the real standard of human life and what is the real standard of spiritual life. Otherwise, we'll just accept the status quo, whatever it is, as it continues to degenerate. We'll accept that as our guiding principles in life. What are the other people doing? They know. Someone must know. In social psychology, this is called the information theory. I may not know, but the information is out there. Someone's got to know. So you just look around and see what everyone else is doing. You know, they can't all be wrong. They've got to know. So, I don't know, but the information is there. It's all around. Therefore, you can feel falsely secure. And even though you don't know, somebody out there around you must know. So by imitating everyone else, you're still informed, even though you don't know. Yet. Makes complete sense. So that is the information theory. We need to hear Srimad Bhagavatam so that we are instilled with both the proper values of human life, as well as the proper values of spiritual life. This verse is actually doing both. As chaste women bring their gentle husbands under control by service, the pure devotees, who are equal to everyone and completely attached to me in the core of the heart, bring me under their full control. You may know how in the ninth canto, in presenting the history of Shukanyat and Chaivanamuni, Srila Prabhupada writes that contemporary people think that by submission, one becomes a slave. Whether it's submission in one's household life or submission in bhakti. You become a slave, you lose your identity. But actually, in both family life and in bhakti, submission is the way to conquer. So that's why the Supreme Personality of Godhead is giving this example. It looks like the, for example, the chaste wife. It looks like she, by all that submissiveness, she's a slave. And of course, in the modern contemporary mentality, everyone's afraid of anything resembling slavery. But Srila Prabhupada points out in the ninth canto, this is the way to conquer. And the Supreme Personality of God is confirming that in this verse. This is how you bring the situation under your control, through service. Similarly, this is how you bring the Supreme Personality of Godhead under control, through service. Just see the full potential there in devotional service. The Supreme Personality of Godhead himself is letting you know, I can be controlled. Here's how to do it. This verse is using something called Shaka Chandra Nyaya, the logic of seeing the moon through the branches of trees. A little child, if you try to point to the sky and say, see the moon, the child's too tiny and can't crane his neck up to see the moon. But if you point to something nearby, see that tree right there. The child can easily perceive that there's a tree there. Look between the branches. Child can look between the branches. See through the branches, there's the moon. The moon is far away, but by using something nearby, the child can actually conceptualize enough to begin to perceive the moon. So similarly, this verse is doing that. Just as chaste women bring their husbands, their gentle husbands, under control. Notice it says gentle husbands. The men like to forget that part. The Shastra says, I am the guru of the home. I am the lord of the home. Isn't there some verse that actually says the husband is the Supreme Personality of God? Well, here it says, gentle husbands. Sapatim unto the gentle husband. Only a devotee can actually be gentle. You see, material desires make you rough, no matter how cultured your exterior is. You may be very refined in externals, but inside is violence. I want to exploit. So how can you actually be gentle then? Externally, the mannerisms may be very refined and cultured, but inside is the desire to exploit. That means to take material nature and bend it to your will. that's being rough. In fact, that's being violent. Therefore, you can see why the Supreme Personality of Godhead says, gentle husbands, that's fair in the allegory. As chaste women bring their gentle husbands under control by service, the pure devotees bring me under their control. We are getting a fascinating lesson into the power of bhakti. The contamination of Kali Yuga makes it so, we're so afraid of losing our power. When the New Age was popular, it overran New Zealand in the 90s. And there was that expression people would talk about, are you standing in your own power? To have a successful life, you've got to stand in your own power. Know your power and stand in it. Never give up your power for anyone. Like a martial artist has his or her stance. Similarly, you take up your stance in your own power. Never give that up. I remember back in the 90s when New Age was all the rage. Now you see everyone figures, since the goal of New Age is sense gratification, what do you need that New Age social philosophy for? Just have the sense gratification. Cut to the chase. What do you need to read so many New Age books for? Just that tell you that you can do whatever you like. Whatever path you want is your path. Why do you even need to read books like that? It all ends up in sense gratification, so let's just start with sense gratification and end with sense gratification. So the 21st century is more advanced. So anyway, when New Age is all the rage, dozens of persons used to tell me, this Bhagavad Gita, we haven't read it, but we've heard it's high on the list of dogma books. Anything authoritative, anything that is said clearly and definitively, that was considered dogma. Some kind of concept that was shoved down your throat. Who is Krishna to tell you how to run your life? Why did Arjuna give up his own power? Why did Arjuna discard his individuality? That's the misconception. And just become like putty in Krishna's hands. And they would stand up for Arjuna's presentation in the first chapter. Arjuna was right. He didn't want to fight. Why should he fight? Who is Krishna to interfere with his life? What does Krishna know? Arjuna is genuine in his presentation that he shouldn't fight. And then this manipulative Krishna comes along and demands his surrender. So these were the misconceptions. We should look in our heart and see, do we also have some tinges of that? How can I give up my plans, my life, to follow Krishna's instructions? I can't give up my own power. I've been thinking about this lately. It's very subtle, actually. It's not all as gross as in every case. It's not. Just I want to feel like I'm in charge of my life. I want to feel that I can shape my life and then give it to Krishna. That is actually okay. In the beginning, gradually one has to make further progress. We've often explained that there is a very thin line between karma yoga and full bhakti. Karma yoga means you give the results to Krishna, but you're attached to what you do. I'm attached to doing this and that, but I'll sacrifice the results to Krishna. Full bhakti means I'm not attached to results, and I'm not attached to acting in a certain way. Whatever Krishna wants, however Krishna wants it. So as I often explain, in the beginning, most candidates in bhakti should look up to karma yoga, not look down at it. Whatever you're attached to, use it in Krishna service. That is something that most persons should look up to. Nevertheless, we should be aware of what's coming down the road. We should be aware of the standard of pure love. And this section of Bhagavatam is teaching you that. Pure love means whatever Krishna wants, however Krishna wants it. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu demonstrates that. It may even seem, Lord Chaitanya says, that I am being mistreated by Krishna. It may seem that way, but let me announce eternally, in all times and all places, that Krishna is my worshipful Lord unconditionally. It may seem that he's handling me roughly. So we should always know what's down the road. We shouldn't fear that prematurely Krishna's going to rip everything away from me. Doesn't Krishna understand I got some things I need to do in this world? Can he just give me some time to do those things? And then later we can talk about pure love. As a loving father, Krishna knows that. These desires are harbored in the heart. Krishna's representatives, they also know that. Bhakti is a very personal, sensitive thing. And who is more expert at being sensitive than Krishna himself? He gave his chakra to Ambarish to protect Ambarish even before the attack by Virvasudeva. And similarly, the Bhagavatam explains that protection is there at the beginning of every devotee's devotional life. We simply have to become more expert to see how Krishna is protecting us, even from the very beginning. So we shouldn't have this fear that everything's going to be ripped away from me ruthlessly as Krishna pounds the pure bhakti out of me. At the same time, it's amazing how trusting we are of Maya. Maya will be understanding. Maya will give facility, appreciation. Whereas Krishna, you just don't know. You don't know what Krishna's going to do. You get this edgy, uncertain feeling. Just when I am on a good wicket, just when things are going nice, you got that fear. Krishna can see I'm attached and he can yank it all away. Not ready for that. I'm not ready. Krishna knows the capacity of each bhakti practitioner better than us. It's like a parent who understands that a child can do better, even though the child may not know that. So the expert parent lovingly arranges for the child to mature. Don't we think that Krishna can at least match what a good parent in the material world does? Of course, these days, practically everyone comes from a broken home, so there's that edginess that we carry around in our material identity, and that influences our approach to bhakti. Lurking in the subconsciousness are the traumas of seeing parents split up or never seeing both parents together, or not even knowing who one of the parents is. So that produces this kind of edginess. Whether we recognize it or not. Due to the traumas that are so prevalent these days, Our cage is rattled, so to speak. And therefore that being rattled by the traumas of material life influences how we live at Krishna, unless we've taken the time to get sufficient knowledge. Just like these 15-year-old girls who were telling me about the latest way to party. It'll destroy them. By the time they're 21, they'll be just burned out hulks. And then if they're fortunate, if somehow or other they can approach devotees and take up devotional life, those scars will be there and will influence their approach to bhakti, unless they have some knowledge and some patience to get over the debris that they accumulated, not only in this life, but so many lifetimes. This is a subtle point, but think about it. Not simply the traumas that we can remember in this lifetime, but the traumas of many lifetimes have made us very insecure. And so that insecurity influences our vision of Krishna. And therefore it's necessary to constantly hear Krishna's glories so that we develop that confidence in Krishna so that eventually Krishna can trust us. How can you trust someone who's insecure? Everyone knows, in the ordinary sense, when you've been around someone who's insecure, they're just not stable, you just don't know what's going to come next. So if we want to be dedicated servants of Krishna, we have to deal with our insecurities. And how do you deal with your insecurities in bhakti? The main and essential way is to hear about Krishna and engage in Krishna's service. Sometimes it happens that the traumas of this lifetime are so great, one needs professional material help to sort that out. Srila Prabhupada himself said that when the car is broken, you go to an auto mechanic. When the body's broken, you go to a doctor. Okay, when the mind's broken, you go to a psychologist. But that is not the main or essential cure. The main and essential cure is get over your insecurities by hearing about Krishna, engaging in Krishna's service. Getting that actually cleans out those traumas. Of course, if we're not chanting with enough attention, if we're not investing our heart sufficiently in devotional service, then those traumas can still resonate in our heart and even impede our relations with other devotees, impede our giving for Krishna's service. So there's so many types of traumas that we see these days. Practically everyone is trauma-ridden. The party scene has burnt everyone out. It's caused ladies to have no self-esteem. A lady without self-esteem is a miserable creature. But that's what contemporary society is converting ladies into. Just be a garbage can, trash can. It's cool. Everyone's doing. And once a lady loses her self-respect and self-esteem through the party scene, she doesn't value herself anymore. So there's this sense of worthlessness. Everyone hates me, no one cares about me, no one should care about me, no one should like me, I don't even like myself. And the men who played the predator game, they think, oh, by being a predator in a party scene, you display your power, you display your mastery, but actually the men are destroying themselves also. They become so weak, so feeble-minded, spineless. As we've explained so many times, that when the ladies read the qualities of a real husband in the Bhagavatam, they start to wonder. Where are these men we're supposed to surrender to? Where are they? So my point is that contemporary society is crushing even the finer material instincts of human beings and converting in mass the population to be so insecure and trauma-ridden. And those scars actually affect our approach to Krishna. And therefore we're insecure about Krishna. What's he going to do to me? What's he going to take away? Like a girl's been date raped, which is so common these days. Oh, what's this guy going to do? So again, this is a subtle point. It's something that requires some deep self-reflection. What is in me that is causing my insecurity in relation to Krishna and Krishna's service? Okay, we all know it's basic rebelliousness, insubordination. But it has a particular wrapping due to our circumstances in life, due to our mistrusts accumulated after being crushed by so many material experiences. And will Krishna actually deal with me properly? That's our bottom line. And it takes some deep soul searching to see that in the heart. Will Krishna actually have the sensitivity and knowledge to bring me along in bhakti through thick and thin? No one's ever done that before. I've trusted so many persons. They've all shafted me. They've let me down. I've learned how to tolerate, have a stoic attitude, just tough it out. To live material life, you know, you've got to develop thick skin. When I'm talking to new devotees, a question that I often ask them is, well, you seem to be a bit sensitive, a bit thoughtful. How did you make it in material life? They always say, I didn't. I was discussing it with one of the brahmacharis. You're kind of thoughtful, you know. You're kind of reflective. What did you do in your non-devotee days? How did you keep from going crazy? Told me. I just played computer games all day and night. So I kept my sanity. I've talked to lady devotees who explain how at first they tried to resist the party scene. They tried not to get so much into it. They all said, I didn't get so much into it. What is so much and what is a little? Well, anyway, the response is always, I wasn't so much into it. But then the popular pressure is so great. You've got to get into it for a couple of years. So generally upon further questioning, when I say, well, what do you mean by you weren't so much into the party? You say, well, for a couple of years I got into it, but then I quickly realized. After 2 years, I quickly realized. What is it you quickly realize? That if you're going to live material life, you've got to have thick skin. You've got to tough it out. Take your hurts. Dish out your hurts. Be as charitable as you can without jeopardizing your own situation. Because remember, you've got to stand in your own power. That's as best as it gets, right? Stand in your own power. Never give up your stance. Then you come to bhakti, and what do you hear? We're powerless. We want to act according to Krishna's desire. So now, The Supreme Personality of God Himself is explaining. For those who have no material desires in the core of their heart, for those who want to be my pure instruments, I'll come under their control. This example of Maharaj Ambarish is in an opulent setting. You have the Lord of Vaikuntha explaining this to Durvasa Muni. So this section of Bhagavatam is in the context of awe and reverence, aishvarya, opulence. The same principle is there in the topmost portion of the spiritual world in Goloka Vrindavan. But there's no aishvarya influence. It's all madhurya, sweetness. But you see, even in Vaikuntha, the Lord of Vaikuntha is saying, I'm sold out to my devotees. To see that principle in its sweetest, though, you have to go to Goloka Vrindavan. Remember Mother Yashoda chasing little Krishna, Bal Gopal? How could she catch Krishna? The greatest yogis can't catch him with all their mystic power. Yet, she caught her little child from behind. And then, she threatened him. She's holding a stick in one hand. She's got her little Krishna by the other hand. And she's threatening, I'm going to punish you. What was little Krishna's response? He knew the right thing to do now is to put on a complete display of fear. And that way his mother won't chastise him. So as the Dhammadharastika prayers describe, he made his whole body shake. His little body was shaking, so much so that his pearl necklaces were shaking. He was breathing, sobbing. He was rubbing his eyes with his lotus palms. Now there's two ways of looking at is rubbing his eyes with his hands, and the mascara around his eyes is running down his face. He's rubbing his eyes either to wipe away the tears, or the acharyas say he's rubbing his eyes to produce more tears. And Mother Yashoda, the acharyas point out, she's telling him, "You butter thief, you pot breaker, you friend of the monkeys." And little Krishna is crying and breathing heavily and begging his mother, "Put the stick down, put the stick down." She tells him, "Do you promise you'll never do this again?" "Yes, yes, I promise, but first put the stick down." What a scene. But it doesn't end there. It just gets sweeter and sweeter. Mother Yashoda, of course, had no intention to use the stick, but she wanted to frighten her child. "Don't you do any mischief again." But then, being an expert mother, she thought, "All right, enough is enough. I don't want to psychologically scar my child by frightening him too much." So she put the stick down. She's being sensitive toward the Supreme Personality of God. She's standing in her own power. I don't want to frighten Krishna too much. I don't want to frighten the Supreme Personality too much. Of course, she doesn't think he's God. She never thought he's God. She thought, "This is my boy. It's my duty to raise him properly. I don't want him to be paranoid, so I'll put the stick down. But I see that he is so restless, he may just run out into the forest. Therefore, I should bind him." So that's how she got the idea, to tie up the Supreme Absolute Truth. He may run out into the forest. He's just so agitated with restlessness. "I'll tie him up, and that way he'll be peaceful. He won't get into any more trouble." So she got a few ropes from the house, as you know. And she proceeded to begin to tie up the supreme absolute truth. Now, this is the point you should be meditating on. This is the same principle that you see in Ambarish responding to Durvasamuni's attack, and then the lessons taught by the Supreme Personality of Godhead to Durvasamuni. The same principle is there, but it's totally devoid of awe and reverence. It's all on the spontaneously sweet Vrindavan plane. Mother Yashoda is genuinely thinking, this is my boy. He's an extraordinary boy. Gargarishi, at his name-giving ceremony for Krishna, did point out, my boy sometimes would be empowered by Narayan. Okay, very well. He's still my boy. And I, as his mother, have to care for him. So therefore, she's proceeding to bind the Supreme Absolute Truth. The Supreme Absolute Truth has no beginning or end. How do you get a rope around something that has no beginning or end? And the Supreme Absolute Truth is not in time. Krishna says in the Gita, Kalosmi, I am time. Time is his energy. So how can you use time to control Krishna? In other words, how can you say, step one is that I get the ropes. Step two is I join the ropes together. Step three, I put them around the child's waist. This is all time, you see. This is all sequence. So first of all, the Supreme Absolute Truth can't be measured. It's unlimited. How do you get a rope around that? Secondly, how do you do a step one, step two, step three when Krishna's beyond time? So she's up against time and she's up against space. She's, conventionally speaking, she's operating in time and space, but of course in Goloka Vrindavan, in Krishna Leela, when he comes to do his Boma Leela, his earthly pastimes, his devotees, like Mother Yashoda, they're not affected by material time and space, but as part of the Leela, they're acting in that way, as if they're under the control of the laws of nature, time and space. So she sets out to do the impossible. She's going to bind Krishna. And what is Krishna thinking? No way. I've got things I'm going to do today. If she binds me, how will I play with my mates? And I want to do more mischief. I want to steal more butter. I'm not ready to be bound. As Krishna is thinking that, his opulence potencies, Satya Sankalpa, which means, in short, his will be accomplished. And his vibhuti shaktis, his power and might, inconceivably unlimited. All that responded with a chance to do service for Krishna. His potencies, okay, here we are, Krishna. We know what you want. You don't want to be bound. It's time for us to help you. We are your potencies. It's time for us to help you display your omnipotence, even in Vrindavan. So for a while they could do that. Krishna was showing his stubbornness. But Mother Yashoda was also showing her stubbornness. So there was a competition between little Krishna's stubbornness and his mother's stubbornness. She was determined to bind him, and he's determined, no way. So therefore, every time, as you know, she went and got some more ropes, still she couldn't bind Krishna. The ropes wouldn't go around little Krishna's waist. So Mother Yashoda, she's meditating on this point. Wait a minute, I know how tiny my little boy's waist is. And I'm getting rope after rope, joining it together, and each time there's a gap of two fingers. Now this mathematically doesn't make sense. Why should the gap not be four fingers or three fingers? Why doesn't the gap change? Each time, no matter how many ropes I get and join together, the gap's always two fingers. This doesn't make sense. So she's laboring very much. Perspiration is coming down her face. It's transcendental. She has no material body. she's not an ordinary devotee. Krishna doesn't have an ordinary devotee as a mother. She's not someone who attained that post by sadhana. Flowers are falling from her hair. She goes and gets more ropes. Meanwhile, her elder gopi friends, they're smiling. This boy can't be bound. Isn't it obvious, Yashoda? There's something special about her. She's smiling too, but still, she's determined. She says, I don't care if I have to stay here until nightfall and get every rope in the village. I'm going to see the measurement of my boy's waist. He's determined, stubborn. And as we said, little Krishna is also stubborn. No way, I'm not going to be bound. Let my potencies manifest. I'll be immeasurable. But then, little Krishna notices his mother's efforts in pure love. He notices how determined she is to care for him, to love him properly, to protect him, even by tying him up. So her determination is called Bhakta Nishta, the determination of the devotee to serve Krishna no matter what. So Krishna has his own Nishta. He has his own determination. It's called the Swanishta, his personal stock of determination. In the beginning, it seemed that Krishna's Swanishta was to do his own thing. I'm not going to be bound. I've got to play with my friends. I'm going to let my opulences reveal themselves. But that is not the deepest level of Krishna's Swanishta, his determination. The actual deepest level of Krishna's Swanishta, his own personal stock of determination, is the determination to come under the control of his devotees. So that's what finally went out. Impressed by the pure love of Mother Yashoda, her desire to care for him, her determination, her bhakti-nishtha, the kripa, the mercy of Krishna overpowered his opulences, and his opulences receded into the background. And just like a regular little boy, Krishna allowed his mother to bind him. There are some essential contradictions that you should keep in mind while hearing Damodara Leela. How is it that Krishna's Atmarama, self-satisfied, yet he's hungry enough to go stealing butter and breaking yogurt pots? You're meant to contemplate these paradoxes as gateways to pure love of Krishna. The great devotees of Krishna always point out these contradictions. Queen Kunti points that out. Then you consider the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Om Purnam, perfect and complete. Yet why is he apparently so dissatisfied that he's got to go breaking into people's houses? You break into people's houses, you're a thief because you're dissatisfied with what you got. You're dissatisfied that others have what you don't have, and so you want to take. So how is the Om Purnam becoming a thief? How is the Om Purnam dissatisfied enough to go and break into people's houses? This perplexed Mother Yashoda. I've got the best milk products at home. Why does he go to other people's houses and steal? So her elder gopi friends tried to explain to her, it's true that you've got the best in your house, and it's true that he's completely satisfied with what's at your house. It's just he likes to steal. So how is that the Om Purnam? How is he perfect and complete? And then, what happened when his mother was feeding him? It started out like he's hungry. You already pointed out, how does the Atmarama become hungry? Krishna's sleeping in another room. And his mother is churning some yogurt into butter while at the same time eating, boiling some milk on the stove. So Krishna's sleeping in another room. Krishna decides to wake up. I'm hungry! So he goes to where his mother is churning with a churning rod. And he grabs a hold of the churning rod, indicating, stop, I'm hungry, I want to be fed. So Mother Yashoda, fascinated by the cleverness of her little child, grabbed the churning rod. So she picks him up, puts him on her lap, staring into his unlimitedly beautiful face, begins to feed him. And then you know how the milk on the stove begins to boil over. So Mother Yashoda puts little Krishna down and goes to the stove. And what does Krishna do? He throws the perfection of a temper tantrum. He shows such anger that he even bites his lip. You always point out, try to, have you ever been that angry? Did you bite your own lip? That's what he did. So then you ask the question, how can he become angry when he is Vishuddha Sattva? His form is pure goodness, not material goodness. Material goodness is always contaminated by passion and ignorance. So how can Satchitananda, Vishuddha Sattva, eternity, knowledge and bliss, pure goodness, how can that show anger? Isn't anger contamination? And again, let's go look at his stealing. He's Lakshminath. He's the controller of Lakshmi. He's Lakshmidari. He carries Lakshmi on his chest. Yet, he's going and stealing? How can this be? Paradoxes like this, Durvasa Muni could never understand. Durvasa Muni is having a tough time just dealing with the Lord of Vaikuntha. He's getting a lesson from the Lord of Vaikuntha in how the Supreme Personality of God comes under the control of the devotee. But that lesson is wrapped up in awe and reverence, Aishvarya, the power and majesty of Vaikuntha. What Mother Yashoda and Damodar Hari, what they're going through, that is 100% sweetness. There's no concept that Krishna is God in Mother Yashoda. And Krishna himself forgets that concept, that he's God. He's, all right, I'm her little child. I'll let her find me. So how is it that the controller of Lakshmi Devi is stealing? How is it that he ran from Mother Yashoda, as the Damodarastic prayers point out, Paramishtam Achantatom Dutya Gopya? That determined gopi, Mother Yashoda, she caught him from behind. It's like you apprehend a criminal who's running away. You chase after the criminal and catch the criminal from behind. Krishna ran away from her in fear. Yet fear itself is afraid of Krishna. What's the most fearful thing in the material world? Who knows?
Birth.
You could say death. What else could you say?
Rebirth into material.
Okay, you could say rebirth. What else?
Losing human body.
Huh?
Dying.
Dying. Well, you see, even in the material cosmos, there's a personality behind everything. So the most fearful thing in material existence is Yamaraj. The Yamadutas, for a sinful person, literally scare you to death. But you don't want to give up your body. But the Yamadutas literally scare the life out of you. So therefore, the Acharyas point out, using Yamaraj as an example, how can Krishna show fear when fear itself, Yamaraj, is afraid of Krishna? Now, how does Yamaraj demonstrate his fear of Krishna? What did his messengers, the Yamadutas, what instructions did they get from Yamaraj?
Not to touch devotees.
Yes, Yamaraj instructed them, don't go near devotees. So in other words, not simply don't go near Krishna, don't even go near Krishna's devotees. That's Yamaraj showing his fear of Krishna. Yet that same Krishna is afraid of Mother Yashoda's stick. Another characteristic of Krishna is Sandrananda, concentrated bliss. Yet he's crying in sorrow when Mother Yashoda's threatening him. Don't beat me, don't beat me, I won't do it again. Put the stick away, just put the stick down. Never again, I promise. This is Sandrananda? This is concentrated bliss? So this is the sweetest situation in which Krishna shows that he comes under the control of his devotees. Dealing with Dvarasa Muni, that's Aishwarya, power, might, reverence, Vaikuntha reverence. This situation in Krishna's Vrindavan Lila is just full of sweetness. Of course, one can even go deeper and present examples in Gopi Lila. Not simply the older Gopi. Mother Yashoda, she's a Gopi also. When Lord Chaitanya says, Ramya kachit upasana vrajavadu vagini kalpita. There's no better way of loving Krishna than that demonstrated by the cowherd ladies of Vrindavan. He's not simply referring to the young ones, he's also referring to the older ones too, Mother Yashoda. Yet and still, Krishna shows even more dependency in relation to his consorts. So much so that he says, I can't repay you for your bhakti. You'll just have to be satisfied with your service to me. I can't repay you. I always point out, especially when I'm speaking at festivals in Ukraine, we're talking about Krishna Lila. We happen to speak about Krishna's confidential affairs with his dearmost devotees. I mentioned that, how Krishna told them, your surrender is so impeccable, your bhakti is so unparalleled, I can't repay you, just be satisfied with your service. That's, you know, that's the reward for your pure love. Suppose, would you take that from anyone in material life? A wife serves the husband devotedly, or the husband serves the wife devotedly, and after such and many decades of service, the husband and wife says to the other, you know, your love has been impeccable, your service has been so consistent. Nothing I can do for you. Just be satisfied with your service. How would that go over? I know exactly. Sign the divorce papers. What is this nonsense? Be satisfied with your service. Because in material life, everything's conditional. You render service, and at some point, you bring out the list, the shopping list. That's why often middle-aged adults go through midlife crisis. It's said that especially ladies go through that. I don't know, but you reach 45. This is considering, especially conventional society, where people would marry in their 20s and have children in their 20s. And then 20 years later, by the time they're 45, they think, wait a minute, where's my life? I gave everything to my wife or husband, lived for all, for my kids. What about me? And old age is coming. I've got to go for it now. I've seen this even affect weak devotees. They just go berserk at the age of 45 because unconsciously old age is knocking on their door. And so they realize, I've got like 5 years to get some enjoyment. Did this lady give me all the possible enjoyment? I stuck it out for 20 years. Now I'm 45. I could be coming up short. I'm going to be old. And I've never sufficiently enjoyed. Horrible. I've never had the peak enjoying experience. Oh my gosh. I'm getting old. No. No. So, this is a famous period in human psychology. Suddenly people just drop their families, drop their careers, move to another place, change jobs, this, that. Desperate. I've got to score before the game ends. In rugby, do they have like some kind of warning before the last part of the last moments of the match? In American football, they have, you know, the 2-minute warning. They don't do that in rugby, huh? No. They just let the clock go. Yeah. So, in American football, the 2-minute warning, that instills panic in the losing team. Oh, we've got 2 minutes, we've got to score, otherwise the game's over, we're lost. So, similarly, Maya does that to get just results. 2-minute warning, you're 45, you still got some good looks, muscles are starting to fade a bit, but you can still do it. Come on! Put that makeup on! Get some new fashions! Get out there! Powder over the wrinkles! Dye the gray hairs! Come on! Men, start going to the gym! Working out! So we have that paranoia that I have given myself fully and I didn't get back what I wanted. This is the nature of material activity, that you invest and you want the return. So you would never tolerate someone telling you, I cannot repay you for your service even if I had the life of Brahma. In a lifetime of Brahma, 311 trillion years, I could not repay you. Therefore, just be satisfied with your service. You'd smack the person for saying that. But this is what Krishna told his dearest devotees. Actually, by his saying that, I cannot repay you, he's saying, I'm under your control. So the dependency of Krishna on his young consorts even exceeds in sweetness his dependency on Mother Yashoda. Nevertheless, we should never make the mistake of minimizing Mother Yashoda's love for Krishna and thinking, I've got to focus on what is the best. The gopis' love for Krishna, that's the best, so that's all I'll think about. Remember, you're giving examples from L.A.? One unfortunate devotee was presenting to Srila Prabhupada that we don't even want to hear about Mother Yashoda and her relations with Krishna. We just want to hear about the gopis. And Prabhupada just exploded. Talk about nuclear annihilation. So therefore, in speaking of Mother Yashoda's love for Krishna, we should know fully that this is the perfection of sweetness. And by Krishna's agreeing that she could bind him, he's actually showing, I'm agreeing to be bound by pure love. It's not the rope that actually binds Krishna. It's Mother Yashoda's love. Nevertheless, At the end of Dhamma Drastic prayers, you offer obeisances to that rope because it's paraphernalia related directly to this manifestation of pure love and pure dependency. Nevertheless, it's not actually the rope that binds Krishna. It's Mother Yashoda's pure love that Krishna agrees to subordinate himself to. By hearing these things, we lose our paranoia. It's so sweet, isn't it, that you actually, well, maybe Krishna's not so bad, huh? The perfection of sweetness, the Madhurya Sar, the essence of sweetness. So this is how to get over those traumas and scars. Especially these days in Kali Yuga, material life means you got some attitudes because of some mistreatment. So many men have attitudes that, you know, they were let down by this girl or that girl. So many ladies have attitudes, they were abused and exploited by men. Then you have attitudes about your parents, conscious or unconscious attitudes. You were neglected, you were abandoned, you were put down. Why did your parents divorce just when you needed them? And all these complexities, these social complexities, produce personal complexities. You get tough. Well, anyway, that's the way the world is. As long as I get what I want, what do I care? If you become rugged and thick-skinned and determined, against all odds, I'm going to stand in my own power, get what I want. Even if you're getting chewed up and spit out by material life, you don't care. All right, so I'm chewed up and spit out. That's all right. I'm still enjoying a little bit. So by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, all the cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, not just simply the 10th canto, the smiling face of Krishna, you start to actually become attracted to Krishna through trust. He's the reservoir of all relationships. He's the reservoir of all sweetness. Okay, Krishna, I'll do what you say. Just like in the ordinary sense. Even though it doesn't happen that often these days, still, people have that ideal. One person telling another person, whatever you want, I'll do whatever you say. It has a particular charm to it, because Krishna is the ultimate unlimited reality of that. Even in the guru-disciple relationship, after years of service rendered by the disciple, the spiritual master can say, whatever you like. That is a personal relationship. And the personal relationship between spiritual master and disciple is meant to prepare us to render service to Krishna in a way that's more and more free of conditions. In Prabhupada's last months with us, when he was on his bed of departure in Vrindavan, and devotees were becoming more and more desperate in there, desire for Srila Prabhupada to stay. In fact, in May of 77, maybe 6 months before his departure, devotees pleaded with him, please stay. And to make a long story short, Prabhupada deliberated about it and then kind of in a very casual, yawning-like way, all right. It's popularly known as the most casual life and death decision. All right, you want me to stay? All right, all right. And devotees, they were just going berserk with attachment and affection. And Prabhupada even said himself, just see how much they love me. He just whipped up their love of their spiritual master, that he just their intensity, he just whipped it up to the max. And even commented, just see. This is the power of devotional service. The guru knows the devotional service is meant for Krishna. So he treats the disciple in such a way that the disciple renders more and more pleasing service to Krishna. Because of that service to Krishna, the guru is considered dear to Krishna. Because of that service. It's not a personality cult. In of himself, the spiritual master is a tiny individual. But because of that precious service of training the disciple how to render favorable service to Krishna, so much that Krishna comes under the control of the devotee, because of that special service, you see the glorification verses of the spiritual master. Of course, the guru always has to be conscious. The service is for Krishna. So in this way, our bhakti affairs go on. Durvasa Muni is learning his lesson. Supreme Personality of God is telling Durvasa Muni, sorry, I can't help you. You're going to have to go to Ambarish Maharaj, the devotee that you offended, and beg his forgiveness. Nothing I can do about it. I'm under the control of my devotee. You can't buy me off. You've got to go to the devotee. Just as Brahma is dependent on me, Shiva is dependent on me, I'm also dependent. You've got to go and pacify the devotee you offended. Thank you very much.